From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. Here's what we've got to wrap up the week. Spotify is taking R. Kelly's music off of its curated playlist. We'll talk about why this move is so controversial. Then Jason Reitman has worked with screenwriter Diablo Cody on three films, Juno, Young Adult, and now Tully. The director says the partnership has an ongoing through line.
Whenever she writes a script, she's articulating something that I'm already feeling, but I don't have the words for. And all of the movies are really more about growing up.
And a documentary about living with a misunderstood chronic illness. All that and more after this. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us.
Now, I'm not trying to be rude, but hey, pretty girl, I'm feeling you the way you do the things you do.
We had a debate in the office about the song you're listening to. It's Ignition by the controversial R&B singer R. Kelly. And the question we asked internally was, do we really have to play his music? Kelly is a very polarizing figure in music, and now it'll be a little harder to hear him on the biggest streaming service in the world. Spotify announced this week that it is removing R. Kelly, along with the young rapper XXXTentacion, from its curated and algorithmic playlists. It's part of Spotify's new hate content and hateful conduct policy. Kelly has been accused, but never convicted, of having sex with minors and making child pornography. Kelly's music is not completely off the service, but Spotify has decided not to promote it. And a fair number of people, even those who believe R. Kelly is not a good person, think that that is a dangerous move. For more on this, I called up Lucas Shaw. He's a reporter for Bloomberg Business, and he thinks Spotify is wading into some very murky waters with this decision.
Spotify has made a decision here not just to kind of censor or remove hateful speech, which, you know, makes a lot of sense, but to penalize artists for conduct which it deems inappropriate. And so it's getting in the business of judging what conduct is and isn't appropriate in cases where somebody hasn't been convicted. Now, we may all believe that R. Kelly has done something wrong, but he hasn't been convicted in court. And so Spotify is just deciding this guy is not okay, XXXTentacion is not okay. And then they open themselves up to having to make decisions about all sorts of other people, because there is no shortage of men and women, but mostly men, who have done bad things that work in the music business and that are very famous. In fact, a publicist for XXXTentacion sent around a list of all of these famous musicians who have been accused of battery or assault or rape and on down the line. And I just think it's very dangerous for Spotify to start deciding who it will and won't promote or support or distribute in some way.
Yeah, and I think we should add, too, that a representative for R. Kelly said in a statement, I'm quoting now, "Meanwhile, though, Spotify promotes numerous other artists who are convicted felons, others who have been arrested on charges of domestic violence, and artists who sing lyrics that are violent and anti-women in nature." So let's step back for a second. What is Spotify responding to? Even if a lot of people have issues with their decision, what was the motivation behind their action?
Though R. Kelly is not as successful or popular as he once was, he is still a professional musician who is performing and has a following. There's been a kind of growing noise trying to stop him in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and all of that. What it was that specifically inspired Spotify to act here, where they said we are going to no longer distribute R. Kelly's music on our playlists that they create, which are a big way people listen to music. What inspired that decision is less clear to me. Spotify has been pretty mum. I mean, they issued this new policy regarding hate speech, but they haven't commented since then. I was supposed to get together with somebody from Spotify today who canceled on me because they are dealing with the aftermath of this decision.
And we should note, too, that R. Kelly was charged and tried in a child pornography case that started in 2002. He was acquitted by a jury on all 14 counts in 2008. But I feel like we should mention Chris Brown. Back in 2009, he entered a felony guilty plea in the assault of his girlfriend at the time, pop star Rihanna. We've all seen those pictures. But Spotify isn't, to my knowledge, removing his music from its playlists, are they?
No, they're not. There's a long list of people who've been accused of things. Just selecting one or two people that you're going to penalize is dangerous, and it causes more problems than it solves for them, really. Much as a lot of us would like to see men who behave badly get punished, I'm not sure that it should be Spotify making that decision.
This is a debate that is not limited to the music business. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences recently expelled Roman Polanski and Bill Cosby, both of whom were convicted in cases of sexual assault against women. But the Academy also kicked out Harvey Weinstein. And without doubting or discounting any of the women and their stories of sexual assault at the hands of Harvey Weinstein, he has not been convicted or even charged with any crime. So what is the bigger conversation and where does it go next? Because it feels like everybody recognizes this is an issue and it feels like people aren't really able to agree on a consensus of what the step should be to either penalize or remove these people from kind of the cultural conversation.
Yeah, and I think it's important to draw a distinction between kicking somebody out of a group to which you must be invited and making it so that other and deciding what other people will and won't listen to. So in the case of Harvey Weinstein, he may no longer be in the Academy, but if you have a Netflix subscription, you can log on and watch a lot of Weinstein Company movies. He's no longer making money from those movies because he's not at the company, but you can watch the movies that he was involved in making. Much in the same way, you know, they can decide that they don't want to maybe invite R. Kelly to perform at their concert. But choosing kind of what they're going to do with his music or adjusting algorithms so they don't appear is making a decision on behalf of the consumer, on behalf of a person, which is, I think, just a little bit different than what we're talking about with different organizations.
And inside the music business, 50 Cent has come out in support of R. Kelly, and Punch TDE, the president of Top Dog Entertainment, the home to Kendrick Lamar, said, quote, "Whoa, are they censoring the music? That's dangerous." What has the reaction been from fellow musician and artists? And is it also kind of a debate among them as well?
Well, it's definitely a debate in the music business. I got calls from a few record label executives yesterday who are apoplectic and just very confused. Spotify had not communicated this decision to them. But it is also worth noting that most of the people that you and I and others have cited as opponents of this are men. I have not heard similar outrage from women, and that probably speaks to the issues that we're talking about here.
Lucas Shaw is a reporter for Bloomberg Business. He writes about the film and music businesses. Lucas, always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise. Thanks, John.
Coming up, the new film from director Jason Reitman and screenwriter Diablo Cody stars Charlize Theron playing an exhausted mother with a newborn who's barely holding on. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The 2007 movie Juno not only was a huge hit and made Ellen Page a household name, but it also launched a fertile collaboration between director Jason Reitman and screenwriter Diablo Cody. The two went on to make Young Adult, a movie starring Charlize Theron as a narcissistic woman shocked to find that her ex-boyfriend no longer pined for her. And now Cody and Reitman have made a third film. It's called Tully, and it also stars Charlize Theron. She plays a mom named Marlo who is mentally, physically, and psychically overwhelmed following the birth of her third child. And with a husband who's not all that much help, Marlo forms a meaningful relationship with a night nurse named Tully. When I caught up with Jason Reitman yesterday, we started off talking about this weird time for him where he's finishing up his new film, The Front Runner, which is about Gary Hart's failed bid for the White House, and at the same time promoting Tully, which is rolling out in theaters.
I mean, the day is broken up into hours, and there's hours dedicated to Tully and hours dedicated to The Front Runner. But the trickier part is when you're in a movie, you are emotionally getting into the movie. And I think that's the only way to be a storyteller is to try to be kind of actually feeling it in real time. And the experience I'm in with Tully right now is people are seeing it and they want to talk about it. And particularly Tully, because it has an unusual ending. People really want to talk about it. So I want to be available in the right headspace to kind of talk about that film.
Tell me about your first conversation with Diablo Cody about this story and what she presented to you.
Well, she gave me a ring and said, "I think I have our next movie." And she said, "You know, I'd like to make a movie about a woman who has just had her third baby, is going through postpartum." And then she said another thing, which kind of gives away the ending. And I should say, you know, you know, the thing about the ending of the movie is that what you realize is you've been watching two movies the whole time. You watch it thinking you're watching one movie, and then you realize you've actually been watching two movies, and there's one hidden underneath.
It's hard to talk about it, given that, you know, people who haven't seen it. But was that thing, that conceit, part of what drew you into the tale?
There's two things that really drew me to make this movie. One, is this ongoing storytelling relationship with Diablo Cody. After Juno and Young Adult, we've made a movie every 5 years now. I think this is hopefully something that will continue for the rest of our lives together. And they feel like these chapters in a diary that we're almost writing together because we're the same age. And whenever she writes a script, she's articulating something that I'm already feeling, but I don't have the words for. And all of the movies are really more about growing up and feeling out of time and too soon for things and too late for things. And it's something that I think anyone can understand. By the end of the movie, you realize that parenthood and motherhood are kind of a location so that we can talk about this other idea, which is what happens when you have a child and you reach that moment where your younger self almost starts to feel like a different person that you don't recognize anymore. But I think if Juno is about growing up too fast and Young Adult's about growing up too slow, this is about the moment when you do get to an age where you have to kind of cease occupying a space so that your child can occupy it. And what are those moments as you say goodbye to portions of your youth? And these are the conversations that, you know, Marlo and Tully have overnight as they're caring for this baby.
You seem like a great mom. Great moms organize class parties and casino night. They bake cupcakes that look like minions. All the things I'm just too tired to do. Honestly, even getting dressed just feels exhausting. I open my closet and I just think, didn't I just do this?
Yeah, but that's the downside of living on a planet with a short solar day. Although Jupiter's even shorter.
You're like a book of fun facts for unpopular fourth graders.
I think a lot of it is also about kindness and the fleeting moments of kindness. There's a tiny scene with an educator and the child whose name is Jonah. It's maybe a 15-second scene, and he understands the kid, and he's just going to be kind to him, and that's all that matters. That's all the scene is about, is this fleeting moment of kindness and how important that is to the story, even though nobody really notices it.
Yeah, it's so funny. Again, I think Diablo could be a very sneaky writer that way, in that, you know, you set up these, you know, first scenes where we're at a private school, and there's a principal, and the principal doesn't understand her son, and the principal keeps on calling her son quirky, which drives her crazy, which I think Diablo maybe secretly put in there because it's a response to every critic who ever called Juno quirky. And then when, you know, she realizes she's going to have to bring her son to this public school, and too many parents are programmed to think, if your child is not in this one private school, they're going to miss out on this private high school. They're going to miss out on going to Harvard. Their life's going to be over. And they go to visit this public school, and they have this lovely moment with an educator. And it's a movie about forgiveness, about forgiving yourself for your flaws. And it's a movie in which Tully arrives at the door and is there to let Marlo know, you're doing all right.
And it's not just a movie about that. And it's not just a movie about a woman. It's about being a mother. And it's about what that does to your body, what that does to your body physically, how it changes your mind, how it changes your sleep patterns. You're obviously not a mother. You're a guy. Mm. So when you're working with Charlize and you're working with Diablo, how do you check your assumptions and make sure that you are telling that story as authentically as it should be told? And what were the assumptions that you found yourself maybe having to correct?
You got to listen. I mean, but as a director, you have to listen. And it's a really tricky thing to do because there's a half of directing where you have to have enough ego to show up on set and have a lot of money on the line and a lot of people showing up to listen to you and they're looking for what they're supposed to do. And you have to have enough confidence to say, the camera's going here. It's going to be on this lens. This is how we're telling the story today. However, if you don't listen, you're going to fail as a filmmaker. My father often said, there's going to be a moment where the movie lets you know who it is. And you have to listen at that moment. And I think that's one of those crucial moments. And you can almost see when filmmakers succeed or fail in that moment. And in particular on this one, I was surrounded by brilliant, funny women who were the guiding light. I mean, Diablo Cody, Charlize Theron, my producer, Helen Estabrook, who I've been working with for years, they were very clear and not afraid to tell me when I had it wrong. And so I was relying on them. And we also, I created this questionnaire for 10 mothers that I knew, and I gave them the questionnaire about the first 2 months of being a mom. And they were unbelievably forthright. Not just with details like sometimes I put my baby on top of the dryer while it's running to help it fall asleep, or I've dropped my cell phone on my baby's face, which is an epidemic apparently. But also, how has this affected their sex lives? How has this affected their marriage? How has this affected their self-confidence, their sense of self, their sense of their body? And reading their words was a larger reminder, they don't feel seen. They don't feel heard.
Jason Reitman is the director of Tully. The other thing that's very important in this film is something that this film has to say about a marriage. And typically, when marriages are depicted as being an issue in a film, the guy is off drinking or sleeping with somebody else. I mean, it's very clear that he is not there. And there's this tiny line that comes late in the film about the father saying, you know, she doesn't leave the kid home alone. And somebody says, well, you were home, weren't you? That he is present but absent. What were you trying to say with Diablo about marriage and about what men do and do not do and what they assume they're doing, which they're not doing?
Well, I think, you know, dads are, you know, perfectly comfortable doing 10% of the work and taking 90% of the credit. But look, what we wanted to portray was a marriage that was gone, that had gone quiet. Often in films, you'll see first love, and that's exciting. Often in films, you'll see, you know, a marriage, you know, War of the Roses, you know, falling apart. But rarely do we see the quiet, and that's what we were after, was that those moments when you don't talk as much anymore, you're worried about rocking the boat, you get in bed at the end of the day and you each pull out a book or your iPad and you just kind of drift off into your own worlds. And there's something almost scarier about that and funny about that. So I do think Ron is a good dad. I think he, you know, Ron Livingston is a good dad, but I do think his character is a good dad. And he does step up, and he is there. They're just not involved in the way that they used to be.
There's something that Charlize does as an actor physically where she puts on a lot of weight to play this character. What do you notice about Charlize as an actor, the way that her performance is transformed by what she has done to her own body?
It's interesting. You know, I think the real Daniel Day move would have been if, for the first act of the film, Charlize got pregnant for the for the first act. But she just started doing it. She started eating. It's funny because she was coming off Atomic Blonde. She was in the shape of her life. And she started eating. And she just kind of knew this is what she needed to do. And we were talking about it. And she would send me photos of her downing milkshakes and cheeseburgers. And it helps her connect. She wants to feel it. I mean, that's who Charlize is as an actress. She wants things to be authentic, real, and she wants to feel what the character's feeling. And look, she is a very athletic woman who was suddenly putting all this crap in her system, and it messed with her sleep, and it messed with her back, and it gave her depression, and it did all the stuff that eating crap does. And I think that helped her key in.
Jason Reitman, great to see you.
It's great to see you.
Jason Reitman is the director of Tully. He is the co-writer and director of the forthcoming film, The Frontrunner. Tully is in theaters now. The Frontrunner is due out later this year. Coming up, a documentary that's raised awareness about a common but misunderstood disease made by a filmmaker who struggles with it every day. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm your host, John Horn. Unrest is a movie that could not have been made without modern technology, and I'm not talking about high-tech visual effects or camera equipment. I'm talking about basics, iPhones, iPads, and Skype. They are instrumental to what filmmaker Jennifer Brea used to make this documentary, her first feature film. Take the opening shot. You're listening to cell phone footage that Brea shot of herself lying on the floor, struggling to get up. Jennifer Brea has what's commonly called chronic fatigue syndrome. The official term is myalgic encephalomyelitis, or ME. Tomorrow, on May 12th, protests are planned in more than 100 cities, including Los Angeles, as part of a global day of action called Millions Missing. It's designed to raise awareness about ME and call for increased government funding for research. I first met Jennifer Brea and her husband Omar Wasow when Unrest premiered at the Sundance Film Festival last year. And with so much snow and ice on the ground, it wasn't easy for her to get around in her wheelchair.
It is always really hard to travel and to do anything, but it's so important for me to be here. And I think in part because that is, I mean, it's really meaningful to me and to Omar to be at Sundance, but I also think that part of what has allowed this disease to really remain under the radar, especially those at the severe end of the spectrum, is that we can't be seen in public spaces. We don't leave our homes, so no one knows we exist. And so that's sort of why, to me, it really matters to kind of be out there so I can be seen and people can know me, you know, like can understand that this is a really difficult disease and I do struggle with it, and I still do today.
Very early in the film, you remark on camera, "I didn't know what else to do, so I just kept filming." At what point does that comment become the movie?
The scene is actually in the film. I was home alone. Omar was traveling. I had been on the couch, and I had talked to two friends. I had one-hour conversations, which was just too much. And I suddenly found myself unable to get off the couch. And I hobbled upstairs. I got in bed. The next morning I woke up, and my brain and my spine were burning, and I could not get out of bed. And I had to call the church next door to try to get someone to come to me because I couldn't reach him, and I had no idea what to do. And I went to the hospital. I went to the ER. At this point, I didn't really understand what I had. And the doctor looked at me, didn't examine me. I told him I couldn't walk. He said, "You're fine." I said, "I think, you know, I can't touch my chin to my chest." And he said, "That's impossible." And he said, "You have a headache. Here's some aspirin and go home." And it was just this sense of, I can't even go to a hospital and be safe. And then it was also realizing, going online and finding this community, and like I shared that specific story, and there was just these comments on Facebook of, "Oh my God, that happens to me too. I never go to the ER, or when I go to the hospital, this is what I say. Do not tell them you have chronic fatigue syndrome. They will not take you seriously." And it was just this sort of litany of all these people who'd been in that same situation. And I just thought, this has to stop. I needed to change the story, and I needed to believe that the world was kind. And I believe deeply that no one knows this is happening. If they truly, truly knew, this would change.
When we talk to filmmakers, we often talk about the making of the film, and it could be a question of like, how do you get that shot, or how did you cast this actor? But when we're talking about unrest and the making of the film, it is the most fundamental question. Like, how did you make the film? How did you have the energy and the skills and the resources to make Unrest?
So I had no energy, skills, or resources when I began. I mean, I think what guided me was just a sort of a really clear vision and determination, both for what the film would be and what story it would tell and where we would go. And, you know, the first question was raising money. And, you know, I wanted to do a crowdfunding campaign because it was the only way I thought I could get any funds for the film. But it was really hard because at that point, I could only shoot one day a month. So I would shoot one day, then I would crash in bed for 29 days and shoot one day. So it took me 6 months to shoot 6 days to make this trailer. So one thing I learned throughout this process is just patience. And then, you know, with the campaign, I was able to then bring in people to help me. So I have this amazing producer, Lindsay Dryden in the UK, Trish Gillespie in the US, and with their help, started to put together crews to then go and tell these other stories. And it was a really hard thing to sort of try to kind of have teams around the world stay on the same page about the story we're telling, in particular when I could not be physically present. So we tried to find technologies to help me be more present. We used Skype, and I would do interviews with basically a poor man's, you know, like Errol Morris and Terratron. So we would broadcast my image and my audio over a iPad that was reflected over a lens.
So it makes it look like the interviewer is speaking into your eyes.
Exactly.
Right. That's an Errol Morris invention.
Sorry. Yes, exactly. And so that allowed me to have these really intimate conversations from my bed with other patients who are also in their beds. But at the end of the day, I also just had to kind of trust the instincts of people who are actually there. Because to this day, I still haven't been in any of the homes of any of the people that are in this film.
This is a movie that feels like it doesn't have it certainly has a beginning, but it doesn't have an end. And there's any number of ways where you could stop the story. How did you decide when you had enough? And how did you decide that where you were going to end the film is where it needed to end?
I didn't want to tell a tragic story because that would not be true. I did not want to tell an uplifting story because that would also not be true. I think that there is so much darkness and so much light in my life. And that was the truth, the darkness and the light together. And that for me, living with this, learning how to live with this long run chronic illness that I may have forever, was learning to accept and embrace it and to not force an end in a way to the story. You know, there's a story of acute illness where it's like in, you know, a fiction film, the heroine gets sick. There's like a vigil by the bedside, neither she lives or dies. Right. And people want that kind of finality. And I think that works in narrative, but people with chronic illness don't get that. You know, there is no end. Life just goes on. And that's okay, too.
Jennifer Brea's film Unrest is available on Netflix. And you can find out more about the millions missing events at theframe.org. And that's our show for this week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Michelle Lance, and Monica Bushman, with help this week from Jonathan Shiflett. Our interns are Maria Alexa Kavanaugh and Marcy Landgren, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.